Welcome to the Theorist Composer Collaboration, a podcast series highlighting modern composers and their compositions. My name is Aaron DiZarilla. I'm the host of this podcast and also a graduate music theory student at Florida State University. Today we have a special episode, the second TCC roundtable, with today's discussion being on the topic of the classical canon. These roundtables are occasional breaks from the interview format of the typical TCC episodes, showcasing casual conversations with various people in and around the music academic industry on the panel. Speaking of the panel, it's time for introductions, and up first is Albert Wheeler. Long Island native Albert Wheeler is a master's in music theory student at Florida State University. Before arriving in Tallahassee, he attended the Aaron Copland School of Music at CUNY Queens College. He received a bachelor's in music education while competing in track and field for the Knights. His primary instrument is the violin, allowing him to play in prestigious venues such as Kodak Hall at the Eastman School of Music and Carnegie Hall in New York. His current research interests include pedagogy, Greek popular music, and topic theory, which leads me to welcome Albert Wheeler himself to the podcast. How are you doing, Albert?
Great, Aaron. Thank you for having us, and good morning, Pam, as well.
Yes, of course. Happy to have you on, another fellow theorist. And for any sharp listeners, you know that Albert is a peer of mine on a weekly basis. We are both graduate music theory students at Florida State. And our next panelist, of course, is Dr. Pamela Mireles, who is a Mexican-American violinist with different talents and strengths in her musical career. She earned a bachelor's degree in violin performance in the Escuela Superior de Música from the Fine Arts and Literature National Institute in Mexico City, and her master's in violin performance and her doctorate in musical arts and violin performance with a cognate in entrepreneurship from the University of Florida. Since her studies in the hometown in Mexico, Dr. Mireles has performed as a soloist, joined jazz bands, folkloric music ensembles, new music projects, chamber music, and orchestra performances, both in the classical and pop style. Nowadays, Pamela spends her time freelancing in several orchestras around North America, teaching violin lessons privately and in public education, teaching music appreciation online as an adjunct, and translating in-person lessons and masterclasses from Spanish to English, and vice versa. That leads me to welcome Dr. Mireles herself to the program. How are you?
Hi, Aaron. It's nice to see you. And hi, Albert, too.
All right. A great group of people. Dr. Mireles, how I know her is that she was still working on her, well, she graduated with her doctorate my first year at University of Florida. And she was like the, well, not even de facto, pretty much the head of the violin studio aside from the professor. I have to say, Pam, or Dr. Mireles, that I always found you very scary.
A lot of people find me scary, and I don't know why, because I'm 4'10". I think
okay,
it's
see,
my voice, though.
No. It's see, you might be 4'10". See, I'm 6'1", and you might be 4'10", but to me, you have always appeared as 6'10". Oh, anyways, so, you know, here we are on the second TCC roundtable, and today's topic is going to be in and around the classical canon. The classical canon, a loaded, complicated, but very important phrase for basically any musician, really. So the classical canon is something that, for academics, is something that's very commonly thought of. You know, Albert and I, in many classes over the past year at Florida State, and I'm sure at CUNY at some points, the idea of the classical canon is often debated, its relevancy, the elements within it. And when I say in academia specifically, it might be debated in other circles. It's not that it's not relevant outside of academia, but it's more so just ever present outside of it. It may not be debated, but when you say classical music, that's what it is 9 times out of 10. And so I first want to start by asking Dr. Mireles, we're going to go with you first. How would it, if let's say a 15-year-old violinist or somebody, you know, somebody who's not a graduate student in music would ask you, What is the classical canon? How would you personally define it?
Well, while I was debating this answer that I'm trying to give, I realized there were two parts of me that had the same answer within different perspectives. So my first perspective, of course, because I'm a woman and I'm Latina and I'm still a young person trying to make it in this world, I cannot help saying out loud and perhaps in without shame that perhaps the classical canon is something we attribute to white dead people, especially men, which is a very honest and crude answer. But then I just realized it's pointless to just keep with this perspective of what the classical canon is. So what I did is I started researching a little bit and I grabbed the things that paid my, like that took my attention more from these definitions. And then we can work around that, why it is white dead men music, right? So one of the perspectives that I found is that the classical canon is defined as the greatest, most foundational, and most representative. Those were the three things that caught my attention, right? The greatest, most foundational, and most representative, which thinking it in a way, that's what we've been performing for so, so many years. And it's considered great music, it's considered foundational, and it's considered representative of one style of music. Of course, it still links us with the white dead men, unfortunately, in some points of view. Another thing that I found that caught my attention was that it depends on the tastes and opinions of the general public, which, let's admit it, the most audience we have in the classical genre, it's white people. Right. So as long as they liked it and as long as they thought it was popular enough for the time, that would become part of the canon. And I think we can, if we talk a little bit about music history, we can detect those things that happen. Another thing that also caught my attention, and I think it's a bit more open, is that it is well-known music, which means that wherever you can find like the Swan Lake anywhere and everyone is going to recognize it. Maybe they do not know what it is coming from or who Tchaikovsky was, but they all recognize the tune. So within these three concepts that I'm giving you, I think I can reshape my definition, which would be what the audience finds more recognizable and whatever the audience likes the most. Which then pedagogically speaking means that we have taught the audience what we think is the greatest, depending on music history or even in music theory, what we catalog as great music making or music playing, that we are teaching the audience is the greatest of the greatest, which is a term that I really do not like to put with music. I tell this to my music appreciation students, there's no such thing as the greatest music. It's just great because it's music and all music is great. There's nothing greater than. And once they understand that we can enjoy music differently, which opens maybe the gap between what is a classical canon and what isn't, at least for the point of view of the audience. I think I'm rambling a lot, so please stop me.
Oh, no. Not rambling a lot. I like how you laid out your definition or your argument there. And can you restate those three points that you said, the three words that help craft your definition?
Yeah, I mean, greatest, foundational, and representative.
Greatest, foundational, representative.
Maybe
I
we
like
can
that.
Change great instead of greatest because of what I just said. It's just musical is great, but then what's great for the audience and what's great for us as performers and composers, right?
Yeah, and, you know, as you said, familiarity with the audience or what the audience expects, you know, then you ask generationally, why are they expecting it? And so on, you get into that. Well, thank you for that. Very good. And so, Albert, I'm going to throw it around to you, not to give you the second, you know, second helping you have to, not totally repeat, but how would you, to a student, I don't know, to someone who's not 100% familiar with it, explain your definition of the classical canon.
Sure. So especially because you were talking about high school, maybe student who I'm talking to, a 14, 15-year-old, I always go from a scaffolding kind of standpoint whenever I give a definition. So in this case, if I was talking about a canon itself, I would talk about classics first, not just the canon. So classics as in books. And a canon, or when I think of a canon, is a list of books that have become essential to impact an entire field. We especially see that too as we're starting to read more things. Every single class we've ever been a part of, we start with a historization of what happened with that field and how we've gotten to where we are now. So when I think of a canon, I would actually start with something like, let's talk about Homer, let's talk about Dante. If you're talking about maybe Marxism or Durkheim, right? Sociologists and stuff like that. That they're also classic composers. Well, I guess not composers, but they're part of the classic canon also, just a different type of classic canon. So in classical music itself, a canon is just essentially that group of people, not as authors, but more just composers, because composing is a type of authorship. And through time, their compositions have just become a standard of what it means to be a musician. That's the point we try to get to as a musician, is to enter that canon as an extension, right? Because we already know what's there. Hopefully we get there. Now, I thought it was very interesting you brought up my days at Queen's and how much debating we might have done there. I can't wait to talk about that, because I was part of the committee that's starting to expand, refine, and change listening exams that we have there. And what are we considering part of our essential canon itself?
Yeah, sure. I don't think, maybe you've brought it up in some of the classes that we've had before, but I don't think I've ever heard it be related to the literature canon. I think that that's a really good comparison to do. Maybe some of the same more problematic historical reasons, but it is a good framing to understand why it's important, or like why it's lasted for so long, and the importance of the music, importance of the literature. So I really like that.
Especially because it's around the same time frame too, maybe. Like if we're talking about, early 16th century music, that should be part of our early canon of teaching stuff to students. And we're talking about Homer, and we're starting to get to Durkheim, we're trying to get to Marxism and stuff like that. At the end of the day, they're all around the same time period too, right? The rebirth, the Renaissance, everything we can think of. So that's why I probably haven't brought it up in class, but that's because we're in a music specific setting of higher education students and stuff like that. So hopefully we kind of see that already. But yeah, that's how, where I would start if it was a student.
Yeah, I like that. Sometimes, personally, I've started, no, for per not for any particular, I like to understand composers as the people, like who they were individually. And it's interesting reading composer bios, like books or biographies. Sometimes you forget that they were real people who were alive at certain events, and like they knew each other. Like I just learned that Stravinsky was taught under Rimsky-Korsakov. I had no idea. That's I just it's so it's I just see them as like figureheads in history, which is part of the problem with the historization, not seeing them as real people almost. Well, so both of you have already done this quite a bit, but let's get into defining the canon. So we've gotten around what the idea of it is. It's a systematic categorization of some of the most recognizable, well-researched, and well-performed music throughout a modern history, essentially. I'm sure if I wrote down what I just said, I could edit that to make it something better, because this is such a touchy, multifaceted thing. But let's go with that for right now. So, defining the canon, and what I mean by that is, let's speak literally. What's in the canon? And I'm going to leave this open. Anyone can go now.
It's going to depend on the ensemble, I believe. Let me just do it. We're all violinists. What would you call a violin classical canon? I mean,
Oh, that's easy. Well, for us.
exactly. Well, for us it's easy, right? All the Mozart concertos, Beethoven, Brahms, Tchaikovsky, Bruck, Sibelius, the violin sonata as well, Beethoven, Mozart's, right? Then for orchestra, Beethoven symphonies, Schumann symphonies, Sibelius, well, not all of Sibelius, but it's gonna depend on the instrumentation. It's gonna depend on the ensemble. I think in here maybe it would be more beneficial to talk about which composers are part of the canon instead of which music is part of the canon. I don't know if that makes more sense to you.
Yeah, I'd go for it.
I definitely agree with that. Not so much ensemble wise, but yes, that I think that word is great. I actually wrote down the word location itself is my descriptor of it. And
That is
again,
totally true.
I definitely I see every class I've been in. I mean, everyone knows I'm the token New York student now, right? Because we're in Florida and I'm from New York, so it's I have a different viewpoint for a lot of things because just going down to the politics of my state compared to Florida,
Yes, of course.
it's just a completely different thing. So in terms of canon, I'm New York is one of the few places that's definitely, you know, it has both. It's expanded it, but also has restricted it more than anything. So it's like depends what time of year it is. Is it Christmas time? Very set canon. Is it, you know, a random February? Now it's expanded. So location is definitely my big word. When if someone had to ask me what the canon was, I would ask, where are you from? And if they tell me they're from California, I would say, well, it's movie music. And that's what I would say is their canon, and then move from there. Right.
Well, let me zero it in a little bit then, because that's a good point. That's a good point. Depends on the set, because let's say you are an older couple who has a subscription to a specific performance hall, you know, and you go to every single concert. If it's around Christmas time, you're expecting, well, Christmas music or so on. But let's say a prototypical college level symphonic orchestra, just let's say the Chicago Conservatory, I don't know, CUNY maybe, Eastman, Florida
Sure.
State, even University, well, University,
Of course.
Dr. Liu has been doing a bit of work expanding the works that are
Yeah, but
there.
we can talk about that later because it's part of why the canon is the canon, maybe.
Yes, yes. But so the compo, you know, I really like the idea of bringing up the name or framing it around the instrument because that is very true. Sometimes I forget when talking to other people, Albert, you can probably relate this because there's very few string players who are in our program that their canon is very different. If there's any horn players, their canon's much shorter. Percussionists, especially, it's very short. Saxophonists, some of their canon is considered compared to our canon is like saxophone material is wild and crazy compared to ours. Okay, tell me if you guys disagree with this. I would argue that in music history and music theory, instrumental pedagogy, just the way that, let's say, small C classical music is analyzed, the string canon or keyboard canon, and I say keyboard because you got organ, harp, oh, not harp, organ, harpsichord, all that is most dominant.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's also because our instruments are older than most woodwinds and brass. That's why we have,
That's definitely
yeah,
part
I
of it, I
mean.
think. I mean, again, so I have a twin brother. I know Pam doesn't know me personally yet. So I have a twin brother who also happens to be a musician, has a master's in music, a bachelor's, everything. He's a trumpet player. And we actually talk about this all the time, where it's like, he's like, I'm like, yeah, your big pieces. It's like the Hummel trumpet concerto, the Haydn trumpet concerto. And then he's like, yeah, that's about it. So when he does trumpet competitions now, he actually comes to me next. Are there any pieces you would recommend that I arrange or play that's manageable? And nowadays, like Tchaikovsky's violin concerto is starting to be played on a trumpet and expand a
Oh.
little bit. He actually just played
Dude.
Mozart's horn concerto on a flugelhorn, right? Something like that.
Dude,
So.
your brother is a lot nicer than mine. Mine is also a trumpet player. He's a really good trumpet player. He did not ask. He just would grab my concertos and my Bachs and sight read them and then be
I
like, oh, it sounds better in the trumpet. And I'm like, whatever.
don't know about that, but yeah, no,
Well,
that's essentially what it is. And it's like,
mean, I gotta say he did play them very well.
and then you
So.
can and but the that's the exact point that, you know, as string players especially, then it turns into not just our solo rep, it turns into our duo reps and our trio reps and our quartet reps. And next thing you know, he's asking me, oh, do you know of any random quintet pieces that I can play? I'm like, I mean, if you want to play Schubert's quintet in C, that's part of our canon, right? We're using the word canon. And he's just like, I've never even heard of this piece before, even though it's in the classical canon, but I'm a string player, so it's a little bit different. So it's always an interesting opportunity to talk to my brother when I can, because we are, you know, the same exact person living completely different musical lives. So.
Sure. Some great perspectives. I think often in casual conversations, typically people don't use the word canon, but I think of a more easily colloquial way to say it is repertoire. That is our, what's your re my repertoire is really recent. My repertoire goes back since we've been studying music, so on. Yeah. And so, okay, let's not dance around too much longer. Let's define who is in the canon. As Pam has said, Dr. Morales has said, it is predominantly white men who are dead. The dead part makes sense. They're quite old. Well, I'm going to add on European. So it's predominantly old, dead, white, mostly Eastern European or Western European. Sorry, not mostly Eastern European. Eastern European only became quite canonized once the Romantic era came around, maybe late classical. And from there, it's included a lot more of the Eastern European, Russian, and Slavic traditions. But that is predominantly what we're talking about, with some exceptions. Would anyone argue against that?
Nope, I think we are
No, I
you
think it's
defined
fine.
very well, and you're also very well defining what are the correct characteristics, because I think that's why I didn't want to use the term white dead man, because I know it was broader than that. But I think
Yes.
your definition is just it's very specific. I like that.
Yeah, and so that is the canon. Now, okay, why is that? The million-dollar question. Well,
Sure.
there's some obvious things, such as racism and classism historically, whether that's at the time of the compositions or historians, theorists, musicologists, whatever you want to define, people doing archival and theoretical work, looking back on it and judging it, disregarding people because of their race and also because of their gender. There's also a class element, accessibility to the education for composition, being able to have your things performed, and so on. So that's some basic tenets. That's what's brought up most often. Do you guys want to expand on any of those elements a little bit? Go for it.
I always think of the canon as a two school of thought place. Like there's always two branches, and we already touched on European. That's one of the schools for sure. The other one would come down to I would put in quotes conductor, because I think educator is a better way to put that, which I know we'll talk about, I'm sure, at some point. But as in your conductor, your educator is the one who gives you the knowledge as a student, and you soak up every bit of knowledge. I always wanted to learn from my teachers. I'm continuing to go back to school 19 years later, and soon, hopefully 23 years later with a PhD, right? So there's just always this hunger to learn. And what has become part of the canon is whatever information those who are already have a higher degree than me choose to give to me. And then I just accept it as a canon. And then nowadays, we have technology, so you can do a little bit more research, but it doesn't help when top 100 songs to ever come out of the classical music, and then it's every piece that we ever expected to be from. There's never a curveball on there. But in terms of conductors, I always think back to like Leonard Bernstein, where Mahler was not a part of our canon at all until Leonard Bernstein decided to do two complete cycles when he was at Juilliard, right? So it really comes down to your teacher. Your teacher has all those choices of what's in the canon, and that's your choice to accept that, or it's your choice to change it and become more progressive as time goes on.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, the audience point of view, I think it depends on what they are consuming, and that depends entirely on the orchestras and the ensembles that are programming all this music. And if the orchestra wants to play all Beethoven's symphonies in one season, then that's what the audience is going to hear. Therefore, people is gonna acknowledge Beethoven as a composer worth listening to, and therefore part of the canon, right? It's like they will recognize Beethoven anywhere they know Beethoven is. They will know that Beethoven is good music, and they'll recognize it. So for them, it's going to become part of this emotional gap that we have with music. Not gap, sorry. This emotional connection we have with music, right? So I also wonder if, and it could happen as a student, right? I remember my first time listening to Tchaikovsky. I can't remember right now what was it, but I remember falling in love completely with it just because I liked the music. I didn't know who he was. I didn't know he was Russian. I didn't know he was dead and white. I just heard his music and I fell in love with it. And that's what also we have to be pay attention, because honestly, we're here because we are feeling things, aren't we? So if we just like how the music makes us feel, we're going to make it part of the canon one way or another.
Sure.
So that makes a lot of sense, especially if we're talking about high schoolers that are feeling everything. If the music just makes them feel everything, they're going to love it no matter what.
Fair enough. A very good point. So I'm kind of parsing two elements right now. One is the effects of pedagogy, whether that's at the instrumental or ensemble level. And then the other is the reception or expectations of the public. And so let's stick with pedagogy for right now. Let's stick with that. I guess what I ask is it a problem that although there has been movement over the past few years and reconciliations of trying to expand the canon and make it more diverse and wide open in terms of the representation of the composers and the music within it, is it an issue to be? Well, I should say, I personally think, yes, it is an issue that in pedagogical terms, there is a firmness over time of almost immovability in accepting larger swaths of music. And in my experience, you both of you, of course, can speak to your own. It's not even just based on gender and race. It's also just not moving without outside the canon. For example, there was a violinist at University of Florida who went to our professor with a piece by Amy Beach, someone who is alive well within what the canon is, a female composer. There are people who are considered within the canon who were alive after and right at the time as her, but she is not typical. I mean, maybe for us who more regularly engage with music that's a little bit outside the veil, but for the general public or general performers or educators, Amy Beach would not be. And when brought this piece, like, oh, I would like to learn this or perform this, she was told no, because it's outside of the structured canon-based curriculum, even if it is still within like the time period, the style, and so on. So my question, I personally think that is a strong problem. So I gave an example of a female composer, but it's more to say that it's not like the style of Amy Beach is some wacky, crazy thing. It's just, it's excluded historically on the basis of gender, but even now, just because it's not part of the zeitgeist of instrumental pedagogy, it's not seen as something on the level in terms of educational benefit. So what is your guys' thoughts about that?
Well, I personally think that if you're trying to teach your students music, you're doing the wrong thing by saying, no, you cannot play this because it's out of the canon. I don't think that's very appropriate in the pedagogy part. If you're trying to help your students learn, it doesn't have to be everything in the canon. We have plenty of time to learn that. So we might as well learn new music or different music, or not even different music, just music that is out of the canon. Well, especially if it doesn't break any like rules of style, period, whatever, ensemble, whatever it could be the other problem that might arouse.
Well, before you jump in, Albert, I'm going to play like mild devil's advocate, or I'm going to throw something back. So for college, I think that makes perfect sense. And it wouldn't be too insanely difficult to do that if you have a studio to introduce music, such as like, say, Amy Beach, or, you know, this sounds weird, but for violinists, this is great, you know, having Vaughan Williams, which that's mm-hmm. not insane, but for a solo violin rep, that's not typical. Compared to others. But let's say a high school student or middle school student might be going a little too early, depending on their level. But what about there? How would you feel as a teacher if you had the option between, I don't know, a Mozart concerto, teaching them a Mozart concerto versus something else that is of similar difficulty and technical demand, but is not part of the zeitgeist?
I was thinking in one of the bullet points. All right, so I'm just going to talk about it right now. So the most common answer would be no, because we think or we are taught that we should follow a list of repertoire of what we can do before what or after what. And if a high schooler arrived and asked me to do something out of the canon, I would probably convince them to do something inside of the canon. But now I'm questioning myself, why would I do that?
Not to put words in your own mouth, but if I was in that position, my internal reasoning would be, well, they probably want to use this as audition material. You know, they want to be successful within, let's like violin.
Okay.
They want like to have a Mozart concerto under your belt, just ready, is, I would argue, almost essential if you want to be a successful performer or apply to colleges. Mm-hmm. And so, because I don't want Albert sitting on the benches too long, I'm going to throw it over to you. What are your thoughts on all this?
Maybe I like sitting the bench. No, okay. I agree. I mean, it depends on what your student's end goal is. I definitely think that's a big part of it, because there's plenty of people who are going to only play their instrument through high school and call it a day. So if they're going to only play through high school, I would say play whatever makes you happy, because you're only going to have 4 more years to play your instrument anyway, from that perspective, as in you don't think they're going to keep going, or they even choose they're not going to keep going, no matter how much you push them to do it. I was even one of those people. I did not think I would go into music after high school. I was so set on sports. I was so set on everything else that I could have done. And then within 3 months of college, I was like, I need to keep doing this. I'm going to keep doing it. So I definitely think if you're doing it for just a showcase of playing your instrument, you like a piece, play it. It's going to make you happy. But I 100% agree. If I ever showed up to an audition, I didn't have Schumann's scherzo from his second symphony under my fingers as a violinist, I should not be auditioning. That's something that needs to be under my fingers. So it's a very loaded question. Now, in terms of, we were talking about Amy Beach a little bit. She's 100% in our canon. So I think that's a not wise judgment to say, oh, you can't, especially if I'm thinking of the one piece off the top of my head, or the Romance for Violin. If I was told I can't play the Romance for Violin, I'd be like suing the school. And that's the action I would take, because it's 100% within the canon, under representation. You know, you're supposed to try to expand as much as you can, but it's not like I'm taking a film score and trying to play it as my opening piece, which is slightly different. Not saying it may not be, like, it's in our canon, but it's a different concert hall vibe, right? Mm-hmm. You go to, we're showing Star Wars A New Hope here in Tallahassee in, I think, a week or two, right? You go to a specific event for something like that. If I'm performing my senior recital, I'm not going to do anything poppy or anything like that until maybe an encore to lighten the mood and make it happy. But Amy Beach can be a very easy opener for 12 minutes, and you play a romance, which is part of the topic, and that can be, you know, topic theory we can talk about later for music theory pedagogy, right?
Oh geez.
So it's the winter topic. No, I'm joking. So it's definitely you know, knowing where the field is going to, that's the first question that we got asked to as music theorists, is where do you think the field is going? I think if you don't ask that question as a performer too, / educator, that's part of the problem. You need to know, where is the field going? What are we trying to accomplish? And if that's play underrepresented music, then why would you ever say no to Amy Beach? But if that's, I want to stick with your undergrad degree to be as canonized as possible, and you play your Bach and you play your Butant and you play your Sibelius and go in your order that you're supposed to, and then grad school is where you expand, so be it. That's just a conversation you need to have with your professor itself.
That is true. I like that idea, actually, of like planning how much you want to learn while in school, and how much you want from the canon and how much you don't want from the canon.
So here, you know, here we are arrived at the eternal question of practicality versus desire, because all three of us are educators in different ways. You know, Albert, you've taught violin lessons, I've taught violin lessons, and you've also are teaching aural skills in music theory. I'm teaching songwriting. Dr. Morales has taught a numerous number of different musical ensembles, solo lessons, and classrooms, and so on. So I honestly, at the high school level, because you're trying to prepare people for the wider world, essentially, getting ready for them to leave, it would almost, even if you're intellectually trying to have the best intentions, going too far outside the canon might stunt them a little bit in terms of their auditioning capabilities. That's not their fault, and that's not our fault. That's just the way that the institutions built over time. I would say, arguably, for a lot of the reasons of racial and gender bias over time, and then that gets compounded upon over the decades through nicer means, but it still has that origin. But at the end of the day, that's the way that it is. There's not much as educators we can do at that level. Now, we get to the college level, that's a little bit different. So I'm not trying to ask you guys, because I didn't ask you to prepare this, and this would be a big thing, but if you guys had a violin studio, you know, how would you approach that? Because, for example, Dr. Morales knows this very well. Our weekly diet, at least for the undergrads at University of Florida, was that we had an etude. I don't think you can argue against that, of various books, depending on your level. Then we had solo Bach, and then whatever major piece we're working on. Each week we had those three things.
And the beautiful part is that it could be either a concerto or a sonata or a show off piece. It could be anything, as long as it was major. I think we have to pay attention to that word, major piece of violin repertoire, right?
Yes. And I would argue part of Dr. Lauer's reasonings for that was to prepare us, again, like the high school mindset. What are your guys' thoughts once you get to the college level, if you were in charge of a violin studio? Oh, and when this relates to the canon, wanting to be more inclusive, but also being practical in equipping your students.
I'm going to let you talk first, because I have a very strong feeling, opinion about this.
Especially sure, no problem with that. About
my professor.
Of course. I agree that at Queens, I did kind of the same exact thing. You know, I had my Dunas Daily Dozen I always started with, and then I moved on to my etudes, and then you always pick, a showpiece, if we want to put in quotes, anything major. But I think there's two ways to think about it. Definitely, do I want to get a job after here? If I don't learn something, like, even if it's just one really big concerto under your fingers, and that's the one that you get to play for the rest of your life and you get to own it, I'm thinking, like, I don't know, Ray Chen. If you ask Ray Chen to play two pieces right now, the two I would come up with are Mendelssohn and Brooke. He's known for his Mendelssohn, he's known for his Brooke. I'm happy with both his recordings. I've never heard him. I've heard him live like three times now. I've never had a bad experience, right? So I think the point of running a studio is finding that one piece that's, if we put in our repertoire canon, you need to have it in your back pocket. Because what happens if Berlin Phil calls you up and says, we need a substitute, can you play the Brook for me? They're calling you for a reason, and that's to play your Brook, right? So,
and you're gonna tell them, no, I want to play something else.
Yeah, it's like, no, can we actually play like something by Ligeti? It's like, no, like, you need to play the Brook, right?
That,
so it's
that'd be sick.
Yeah, so I think there's that aspect of it. It's just preparing yourself for the field. If you don't prepare yourself for the field, you're not going to get hired, and we're trying to make a living too. Now, I've had open conversations with my own teachers where it's like, hey, I would really like to play this piece that's not played so much, but it's because I enjoy it. And their answer to that is, well, if you enjoy it, come back with it prepared and show to me why you enjoyed it. It can't just, you know, don't just waste your time. There's always something in pedagogy. We can always get something out of something, right? What if it's just like, oh, there's a couple hard shifts in this piece, so we're going to isolate it there. Now you have those under your fingers. And then it's more like an etude also, right? So it always depends on what your end goal ultimately is, because I know plenty of musicians whose end goal was to play on Broadway, and that's a different style of playing. So I'm not going to expect them to play, you know, Vuitton 4. But if they wanted to, they could. And it's a good tool to have. So that's how, it really depends what your end goal is. I think you as the student has that choice, and it's your job of the teacher to guide you, but also respect your choices because that's you are the student. But yeah, you're working with them. So if you need to learn LALO, learn LALO. That's part of the gig, but it's okay to expand from LALO if that's your choice a little bit.
So essentially a student by student, case by case basis, giving
I
them
think
what
that'd
they
be
need.
smarter if you're, because how many studios are possibly over 20 students? Usually you'd have more isolated studios at that point. You'd have more teachers. So that's the whole point of you picking and choosing who to work with. It's Zach Perlman is very, he chooses his studio at Juilliard for a reason, right? And they're going to go through his training for a reason. So it's trusting your teacher. If you don't have trust in your teacher, that's why you take a lesson. Trust your teacher who you're going to work with, but also having that conversation early. Do you mind if we expand the canon if I come here? If your teacher says no, then that should be your decision to go there or not to go there. It should not just be the name of the brand, right?
Okay, fair
That
enough.
is totally true. Yeah.
Okay, Dr. Morales, I'm ready. Oh, we're ready for
So yeah,
it.
no, of course. Well, I mean, I adore my professor. I love Dr. Lauer. Half of the things, or more than half of the things that I do during my private lessons, I do them because she taught them to me. So all these things we're asking is like, I don't know why she does this, why I don't know why she did that. I know why she did it.
Oh,
Because she
boy.
explained it. She explained it very carefully. Like, not particularly. I'm not saying I know what happened to you and what happened to X student. I mean, I did find out, but not that was not the point of the lessons. The point of the lesson was when you have a student that's struggling with this, you go and do that. And when the repertoire is like that, then you move on to something else instead of going through this path. Don't do these concertos, do these concertos instead. And if this happens, and then when the so we talked a lot, and we had to, because that was literally a lesson by required by the DMA program at UF. Like, we had to sit and we had to talk, and I had to do, and she had to correct my teaching. And I really like the way of working that she has, the A to the Bach and the piece. That is just magnificent. The only thing that I would add, and I would also do it by student basis or even a semester basis, is like, I would like you to play at least one piece that you want to play that is different from the canon. But that's something that I would do different than her. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Especially because I made that a policy on all my recitals. I gave four recitals at UF, and I made a thing, and she approved it once I sat and talked through with her that I wanted to play a piece by a Mexican composer in each of my recitals, and she was okay with that. But I had to tell her why it was important to me, because of course this is music she doesn't know. She's like, how am I going to help you if I don't know this music? It's like, you just have to help me however you can. I'll take care of the rest. But again, I was also already a grad school student when I did that. If you're on your undergrad, maybe it's going to be harder unless you prove your professors wrong. Or as Albert said, if your professor just refuses to let you do the things you want to do, then you just move on to another person. You move on to another studio. And that is completely valid. And I keep telling students, do not hesitate of saying this does not work for me, because it's just going to be worse for everyone. So pedagogically wise, I think the canon is there for a reason. It's either we made it a canon and we keep it as a canon, but pedagogically wise, it teaches you us so many basic things and foundational things of the violin playing in general for chamber orchestra soloists. Even for new or baroque music, it's all the basics in there, and it's up to the professor and the students to broaden that canon with the underrepresentative, the music that we like, the genres we like, the combination with the electronics, with the new music, with the baroque style that we barely hear here in the States. That is up to the individual and their relationship with their professor.
Now, here's a question. So, although, see, this is one thing that I try to push back a little bit on with just the existence of the show, the TCC, is to not make newer or more novel. When I say novel, it doesn't necessarily need to be in the past 20 years, just novel composition, not just a fun sideshow. And I'm not saying, I'm not necessarily disagreeing with either of you. I also feel like a bit of a pain in the ass asking some of these questions because I feel like I'm just trying to like stir the pot a little bit, but I'm trying to explore all the angles of this. But, if you get into a cycle of, and this is less on the angle of practicality and more ideology, because practicality as a professor or as an educator, especially for younger people, you're kind of trapped in a circle of you need to do your due diligence of being a mentor and getting them ready for whatever they're going to do. But nothing is going to change if you are teaching them the canon. Like, for example, you said that there's nothing better than those formulas to help prepare you for the symphonic and chamber world, which that makes perfect sense because you are preparing them for the canon by teaching them the canon. Learning German idioms is, of course, through Bach or something else in the early classical period, of course, is going to prepare you for the deep romantic era. I mean, that just makes sense. And Russian style playing is a bit different, but it's easily transplanted from that knowledge. Regionally, they're not super far away, but also just historically, the styles started to meld over the centuries. There's a reason why, other than just historically, there's not as much coverage. There's a reason why we don't study Russian music literature earlier than that period because it was either not recorded or it is so different from the tonal system that we use. So, although I understand on a practicality basis that you're saying that that the canon is important for pedagogical, but the reason why is because of course you're not going to teach them something outside the canon to prepare them to play for the canon. And so although I on a practical level I think you're right, I think that there's still an overall problem of exclusivity. And I'm not just talking on the basis of race and gender. There's plenty of amazing and fine, like for example, two composers that are very famous for, and Albert, I'm going to throw this over to you once I'm done giving this little monologue. two composers who are incredibly famous for how they broke the tonal system. They're both white men, John Cage and Schoenberg. They're both very famous for how they broke down tonality in their own ways, right? But Schoenberg also, I think rightfully so, because it's just beautiful music. Albert, you're actually the one who cued me into this, has some amazing early tonal works, just absolutely breathtakingly beautiful tonal works. And that's highlighted very often because Schoenberg is such a monolith in the canon and honestly just in the history of music. But how come we don't look at John Cage's earlier tonal music? Maybe you could argue it's not as significant on a subjective level, but I'm mildly familiar with John Cage's tonal music, and I would argue it's because he's further on in the time period. It's not as old, it's not as historicized, and it's not as made into a legend like Schoenberg is. Because some of my favorite piano works, just for me to personally play, like in a landscape, are early John Cage tonal works. So removing the elements of bias with race and gender, which is difficult to do when talking about the canon. But why is it that even then, more modern composition is just not in the repertoire? And I'm not talking about pedagogically necessarily anymore, just in general. Albert, I'm going to throw this to you.
Sure. So I guess this is like conversation of is the canon the composer or the composition itself? That's exactly where you're coming to. And I think that's a such a valid point that, we're already we're the problem with the canon is that we're always arguing who's in it itself. And then the question comes once you're in it, how did you come in there? Because we were talking you were talking about some of your Mexican background too. Like the first name that always comes to mind for me is Carlos Chavez, who was a Guggenheim winner, and he has a Symphony Number 2, and it's using all the elements, and but it's also very Copelandian, and it could very easily be confused with Aaron Copland because that's the tonal language we know, and they were really good friends. I can go on forever in tangents like that, right? So I think it really does, Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. It's maybe, is there a book on Cage's tonal music? It starts there. Maybe that's the we have to start of. I know Schoenberg, there's very few on his tonal music too. That's just a rabbit hole on YouTube. I went down one day and I was like, oh wow, Notturno for string and harps. This sounds great. And it's a lovely piece of music that's 4 minutes long. And thankfully, I had the attention span to sit through it and listen to it, right? So I think, yeah, it's a very loaded question that I don't have a set forward answer to. I think if we want to listen to Cage's tonal music, how are we going to do that? You need someone to really fight for Cage's tonal music and bring it on the map, whether that be social media wise nowadays, where it takes 100 people to retweet something, and next thing you know, at least 1,000 people know about it, and that's 1,000 more people who do know about it. That is the argument that we have too. So, how are we getting the word out that these pieces are even out there, that they are lovely? And that can be anyone. I'm thinking off the top of my head, my friend from Juilliard, Zach Nikens, who played bass trombone, he played a piece by Peng Peng Gong, who is a phenomenal composer and has written 13 symphonies now. And he's very like romantic, but also modern at the same time. So that's why it piqued my interest, because it was such lustful writing. And I was like, wow, is this written in 1893 like Tchaikovsky? No, it wasn't at all. It was actually written in 2012. So, yeah, it's, who's putting the word out there? How are we getting the information this music exists? Is it just within the one set orchestra? Is it actually broadened outwards? And again, I think that's where the power of social media can become great. If we use social media the correct way, that's how these branches are officially going to go. Because I'll talk about it when we get to the theory part about eliminating the canon altogether or not. I do have some opinions on that of where I would go from a pedagogy standpoint and where I think the field would be, but how can we expand it itself? I think nowadays it's using social media to our advantage, especially like TikTok. If you get 10,000 people to retweet something on TikTok, next thing you know, it's really 1 million people liked it, but only 10,000 liked it, right? So it's those numbers are inflated, and there's a way to push it in the correct way. It's just a formula we have to teach teachers and PR relation people, and that's how we're going to be able to hit the audience that we want with this music that we don't know.
Sure, Dr. Morales.
Yeah, totally. I was thinking about the composer versus the repertoire, because I was just thinking
That's
the
a really good
only,
point.
and I'm a little bit ashamed of this, but I also shouldn't, because I don't know. The only piece I know by John Cage is 433.
Hey, don't feel bad.
And we
That's
know
don't feel
why.
bad.
And
That's
we
most
know
people.
why. So you're asking, why don't we know another John Cage music? Because we are not talking about it, just like Oliver was talking about. I was also thinking in Schoenberg, why don't we listen to more early? Because no one is playing it. I was also just thinking, what's the most famous Stravinsky? We know Stravinsky had three compositional periods. We only know the first one, because that's the one that people enjoyed, recognized the most. I don't know how to call it. But we don't know the late Stravinsky. No one does that.
I don't.
So we don't know it. Yeah,
I
no.
don't know.
And it's completely different, but no one is playing it. Just like, and that's why I was thinking also, it's more like, yes, it's the repertoire and it's also the compose. I'm debating with myself now with
I think that's a
whether.
great, yeah, I you're talking about an identity crisis too, because what happens if a composer changes? Now, Stravinsky has three periods, along with Beethoven having three periods, and
We know all
Beethoven's,
Beethoven.
yeah,
We know
it's
all
like
Beethoven.
Beethoven we know because people who came after him studied him in such a way. Like the reason why Bach became such a thing. Bach wasn't a thing until Robert
Mendelssohn.
Schumann, a very, very famous person, started the Bach Society. And then
Yeah.
Mendelssohn was his friend. And now those two names have became part of the canon. They said, hey, Bach's music's important. And then they put it into their stuff, like his organ works that has the Bach theme and his second symphony, which is really his third symphony. We talk about that another
And
day.
see, people saw Bach quoting himself in his music. Then we have Shostakovich quoting himself in his music as well.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And then so the whole thing is like identity crisis is definitely a thing because, Stravinsky started out his way and where he was like, I really don't want to do atonal. And then, Symphony of Psalms started coming about, and it's like, oh, how are you going to rotate this tri-chord and this tetrachord or this hexachord? Hexachordal combinatoriality, our favorite thing ever, right, Aaron? Smiley face. But like, eventually he caved and it was like, oh, the times have changed. Let's see what things I can do. I think you're right. Like, although Rite of Spring is the first piece that comes to mind, even if we call it just a big three, like Petrushka maybe on there
Yeah,
might be another one.
the three
And
ballets,
then
of course.
Symphony of Psalms, like that would be third, I guess. Like there's so many. I totally get your point. I think it's because even himself, he was having an identity crisis. His music from the beginning is a different genre in almost like it's completely different. So yeah, I totally understand. The identity crisis is my big point for that one. I agree with that because what happens if a composer late decides, hey, I know I did atonal for 30 years. I'm just going to write tonal music now just because I can. And that's okay.
Just think on Bach's children. They changed everything. They said, like, I don't want to be like daddy. So they went to a completely different path. And there you go. We have classicism now.
Yeah, but it's like, if we're talking of Bach too, it's like he was an admirer of Buxtehude. Unless you're an organist, do you really know who Buxtehude is? Why aren't we also studying his counterpoint that I'm sure is just as relevant as Bach's counterpoint? Because, even Bach's counterpoint doesn't always follow the rules of what we teach in theory. A lot of air quotes around a lot of that, right? So it's such a conversation that, you'll never have an answer to, and that just comes down to you as a pedagogue itself and as a person, but
And that reminds me to Aaron's question is like, why is the canonic, I probably shouldn't say canonic, but the canonic composers are the canonic composers, considering that there were 100 more composers living throughout that period. It's like we had, as you said, other organists, other composers during Bach's and Mozart's and Haydn's time, and we do not know their names. We're just now listening to some names of other composers that are underrepresented, right? As well. So,
yeah,
like, there were thousands of other composers, and they did not become part of the canon or of the common repertoire because maybe Mozart was more popular or whatever. That's what I was saying at the beginning. Whatever the audience likes, it's what we're going to keep playing.
sure. And I really like the dichotomy between is the canonization the music or the composer? Well, it's obviously both because like they're both involved in it, but I think that the strong canon, personally, I think the strong canonization for most people are the composers. Like if like like even something I said earlier, it's I when reading composer biographies, it's weird to think like, Schumann had, I believe it was Schumann, had a very brief interaction with Beethoven, and he was super embarrassed about how it went and like hated himself for a little bit. That's just so funny and weird because I see Schumann and Beethoven as monoliths in history. Like the fact that they interacted at all, or all this stuff was going on in Vienna, it I think right there, even in my own education, which I would say is in the grand scheme of classical education, classical music education was pretty open, actually. And so personally, I think it is whatever through history and analysis people have ascribed to certain composers. We can, like, for example, a greatest composer in history, Beethoven is usually considered in the top five. It's like Albert said, those generic lists, like top 100 classical music, you can kind of assume what's going to be in the top 10, like just roughly. Just off of the zeitgeist of it. And I think a lot of it has to do with the individual composer. Like with John Cage, we consider him a weird wild quack who did a whole bunch of weird stuff, which he would probably find as a compliment.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah. Interesting, interesting. So let's go into, I suppose, so we've been talking about instrumental pedagogy, and we started talking more about defining what the boundaries of the canon is. And Albert, I'm going to give this to you because you have the most experience with this in academia, as you just said, when it comes to the theory portion. We'll talk. Let's hold on to the practicality for a second, like classroom theory, pedagogy. Let's just put that in our pocket for a second. Just in terms of analysis and research, the whole question of expanding, holding on to, expanding, or expunging the canon, those like three different perspectives. I doubt many incredibly serious up and coming theorists say you should only study the canon. So let's go with expanding or expunging. We've talked about that in classes, and you said you have some thoughts on that. So go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, we're in such a unique field where I almost feel like I can't talk about the canon. I say that very, like, I'm a romantic. I would love to be a romantic scholar, as in, that's the music I listen to the most. It's the music that made me happiest. It's the music that made me fall in love with music. So I would love to be a scholar in it. But nowadays, when it comes to research, I almost feel limited because I won't get on a program if I don't word it the correct way. I'm starting to learn, why do we have so many analytical tools in music theory itself? And that's so it allows you to analyze any music nowadays to get to the point you need to. But, you know, it's no longer just Roman numeral analysis. That's where we got to cut to the chase for those who aren't theorists. You know, you have to learn so many different tools to create a new narrative. Like, narrative theory is definitely a thing I think over the past, let's say, 10 years has become the biggest hit. How can we create a new narrative of what this composer actually meant? And how it's being portrayed in music, not programmatic for se, but narrative itself. And yeah, we talked about it in class a lot. And
I'm going to beg a little bit more of something that you said. Can you go into more detail why you feel as though you can't become, let's say, a romantic scholar?
I don't want to word it like that. I think I can become a romantic scholar. My thing is that I can't be a romantic scholar of how papers were early. Like, I'm thinking of when SMT was created and people were probably writing about Beethoven, Mozart, and, you know, our big composers. For me to write a paper on Beethoven right now, it has to be new to the field. And unless I'm using his examples as an example that's new to the field, it's almost worthless is what it's being seen as, because there's other music that hasn't been analyzed, which may be impactful for another analysis down the line. So, I think if I told someone at SMT that I was going to present on Beethoven and I did not have the best topic sentence either, someone would read it on a committee, see Beethoven next, like exactly in that order. They would read my first word of a new analysis of Beethoven, and then already there's a question mark of Beethoven, and then it's like using techniques of so-and-so, and if it's not the answer they're looking for, it's just going to the pile right next. It's just like a really sad Harvard application where everyone has a 4.0, and although everyone should be weighted equally, it comes down to demographic, and it comes down to money, and it comes down to what can you give. And it's like, Beethoven has already given enough to our field, let's move on. Now, on the other side, what if I'm also talking with a Beethoven scholar themselves? Then it's a little different, because we see the value of where Beethoven might still have in our field. And again, I'm using Beethoven very loose here. I'm not saying like I would be only analyzing Beethoven and I'm a Beethoven scholar. I'm just using that name because, you know, we just talked about our giant, right? Beethoven's a giant, and he's someone that if we go to a conference right now, 20 years ago, I'm sure you would see almost exclusively Beethoven sometimes. Like, there might be just a Beethoven panel for three papers, where nowadays it's, you know, you might have to actually claw your way to find the word Beethoven, because you would rather express music of someone who's underrepresented, especially in our field specifically.
So here's a question. And also, I would argue, out of all the quote unquote, it's always funny whenever you go to like a thrift store or see books in a store or whatever, and it's like the giants of composition or whatever, you kind of roll your eyes. But I would argue, honestly, Beethoven, you know, even if you want to be as inclusive as possible, I would really call Beethoven actually a giant, mostly because of his societal impact on composition afterwards. His music is great, but honestly, I would argue Beethoven is a giant of composition, even trying to be as inclusive as possible, because of what so many composers have said about him afterwards. He left a huge impact, not even just his music, but just like societal impact. I'm gonna prod a little bit what you said. So I understand the feeling of, I really want to study this music. I know we're just going to go with Beethoven for an example. I know that could be Schumann, that could be Sibelius, that could be, you know, anything. But I would argue that's that although maybe personally discouraging, I personally don't think that's as bad of a thing if something that is so thoroughly tread over and thoroughly explored is now demanding a higher proof of importance. Because, you know, I personally see it as, well, if you're going to keep going down this same, a similar path as prior scholars, you need a better proof that it's still significant to discuss. And so because when you're submitting it, you're essentially arguing instead of a newer composer or a newer idea, well, you might have a new idea about the music, but instead of newer music, I want to continue going down this line that has been studied for hundreds of years. So you need a higher proof of concept now. I personally, maybe you disagree with my framing. I want to hear what your thoughts are, Albert, but I personally don't see that as a bad thing, but I can understand how it might be personally discouraging.
So yeah, this is where it definitely came down to the type of style of analysis I'm trying to do. I think that's a big part of what we're talking about, because again, are we doing atonal analysis? Beethoven's not, shouldn't be in there probably, right? That's just that he didn't write atonal music, right?
Probably,
so it's,
yeah.
And that's, but if we're doing a topic theory analysis, the whole point of topic theory sometimes is, well, are we starting from way back when and we're defining a field, or is topic theory more the analysis part of it where there's subgenres to this specific topic that's been there and now we're branching out, right? So I think my point more was, this is a hypothetical for you. You're on a program committee and you have two papers in front of you. And it doesn't even matter what their topics are, but you see the names on top. Julius Eastman does this, this, and this versus Beethoven does this, this, and this. Which one are you more inclined to choose?
I'm more inclined to be more demanding of the Beethoven one. You're right in that.
I would argue every person on that program committee would say, ooh, Julius Eastman. I would love to see a paper on Julius Eastman. And then would almost automatically choose Julius Eastman over Beethoven. Even if you have a perfectly polished Beethoven paper at the end of the day, there has to be a time and place for you to present that Beethoven, where Julius Eastman, right away off the gun, knowing that he's a underrepresented composer, that's part of the formula. If you want to get onto a program, you need to choose someone that hasn't been analyzed, because you're expanding our field. And again, I'm not disagreeing with that at all too. And also Julius Eastman's music is phenomenal, so I would love to look at Julius Eastman and I would love to present on it. But you get my point that you know, the first thing we learn in our classes is we get Joe Strauss's SMT, How to Build a Proposal, and they from like 2005, and it's like, this is the God's gift to how are we going to get onto a program. And it's not just our professors, it's us as grad students who can also do it. And that, you know, that definitely is part of it. It's, you know, knowing your audience. And yes, there's still Beethoven symposiums I'm sure I could present that paper at, and then it's all Beethovians and it's a little bit easier. Like, I know Brahms has one for sure too, which, but I'm talking like specifically, what if this is just a flat line SMT, like big SMT or MTSE, Music Theory Southeast? It's like, how am I going to get on there? It's not going to be the Beethoven paper. It's definitely going to be the Julius Eastman paper.
Yeah, this is strongly my personal bias. I still don't see as too much of a problem with that, because I bend towards wanting to include the more. I understand what you're saying though. I still have the internal inclination, which might be negative. Maybe I shouldn't be on a program committee for that purpose, but I understand what you're saying, Albert, with that. I personally still disagree a little bit, but that's more my own ideology. I understand what you're saying, though. I get that. So, Dr. Morales, not to box you out of the theory corner, I'm sorry if we, Albert and I, this is something Albert and I deal with on a daily, weekly.
No, you're fine.
We're about to apply. We're about submitting season is coming up in a couple months. We're about to apply to PhDs. So this is stuff that we literally think about and talk about every day.
As you guys should.
Yeah.
As you guys should. Yeah. No, but like, I'm listening to everything and I was remembering my time as a student when I had to do either the papers or do the analysis for their music. And like, I agree, if I have a paper by Beethoven and then a paper by someone else, I'm going to pick that someone else just because I'm a bit sick of just learning everything one and over and over and over again from Beethoven. It's tiring. It's tiring to listen to the Ninth Symphony and figure out why is it so great. It's like, I've done it for years. Why do I have to do it again? And on top of that, write a paper about that, right? That's what I was just thinking. It's just like, I mean, yeah, the audience, the analysis, but also as a student, you know, if you are trying to impose the canon in music theory, at least for the in the perspective of a student, you overwhelm the student, and then maybe you even are helping to decrease the interest of the students towards different composers, just because you're trying to find something that has already been found several times in different ways, and you want them to find it again in their own different way, which is annoying and it's overwhelming. And some of us want to do something different, you know. That's what I was thinking. That was my overall thought. But yeah, sorry, triggering the trauma.
No,
Sorry.
it's okay. And I think your reaction, Pam, is probably mine as well. But I will say that Albert's talk of, if you have this underrepresented composer and then someone firmly in the classical canon, there is an incredibly strong bias towards someone who's not in the canon. Now, there's a lot of reasons for that. I would argue more often than not, it's good-willed bias, but sometimes there is very cynical, I see the name at the top, pass over. That does happen. That does happen. Albert, I'd see it. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think this is a great time to actually throw in my point before of why using the exact term of eliminating our canon is problematic to me specifically. I have my reasonings for it, and it's definitely has to come from pedagogy. So I think it's a good time to throw that in there. I'm not saying our canon is perfect at all. That's the first thing I need to disclose there. Our canon is not perfect. We definitely need to expand it. But I'm thinking from the perspective of as a theorist, because we teach so much music. And symphonic literature is not the thing we can really teach our concepts from, especially from an undergraduate standpoint. It'd be really hard to teach a class on counterpoint if you didn't have Palestrina or Fuchs because they're in our canon and moving from there. So expanding it and putting lists out there of how to expand it. That's why pedagogy in our field for theory, there's actually never been an SMT is our national place where we, Society of Music Theory, where we meet, congregate every year, and we present papers. There's never been someone who has a pedagogy paper on there. I think
Really?
there's a reason. Yes, I think there's a reason for that, and it's because pedagogies tends to hold a place where we still have to keep that canon intact to teach it. Where once you get to grad school and we have scholars who are also thinking to expand in the same way, that's where we finally eliminate all the canonic pieces that we have. Again, they can be used as examples, but they're not the highlight of your paper. It's someone else and something else because, a couple of professors, I'm sure if I told them I was doing Beethoven, would just look at me with like a tilt with their head. And it's like, well, I hope you're doing Schenker with a big question mark after that, right? So it's, I would get the little dog head tilt, like, really? Did you say that? So, but I think there's a reason for it. It's because pedagogy wise, like, no matter how much I want our canon to change as pedagogy, as a, if I had to grab a sequence for you, I'm going to the Baroque era. I'm picking, I could literally close my eyes, throw a dart at Vivaldi, and find a sequence to teach in the class that day. And there's a reason for that. And that's a tool. So, we need it in that case, especially from theory. And it even works for instrumental too. If I have a student who's been playing their instrument for a few years and we finally want to start expanding to harder repertoire, I'll probably throw Handel at them first because there's sequences. It's a little bit easier. We're in parallel period structures. Right, all these really fun theory terms of form that just makes it easier than, playing a atonal piece by a composer. And even composers nowadays who aren't atonal, it could be then rhythmic that might be harder or something like that. We need a place where there is really basic and cute. I call classical cute. That's what I always use to describe it. If I needed to, why Albert, why do you like Mozart? He's cute. I can go there. It's going to be a 16 bar phrase. It's going to be a 2 plus 2 plus 4, right? It could be a 2 plus 2 plus 4 parallel periods. It's going to do it twice, sentential, right? All these Kaplanian terms. And I'm ready to go. And I'm sitting there with my hands held, with my tea, like little leg up. Like, I'm so ready for this cute classical music. And there's a benefit from that. And also, I understand where I should. There's other composers within that time period I could also be using. But, I just have my personal notebook in the back of like really good examples I found on the radio the other day to show a sequence and just start writing it down to go back to.
Yeah, and to rebuff what Albert's saying, although I'm, as you can probably tell from what I've said so far, I'm very partial of going as far out the canon as possible, but practicality always brings you back in a classroom, as Albert is saying. this might be a hot take as a violinist. I do not like playing Mozart's music. I just don't think it's that fun. I think it's boring, and I think it's very difficult to get the specific techniques down because there's a very specific way to play different idioms. But that aside, if I want to show how a cadential 6-4 works in real music, there's nothing better than this than a Mozart piano sonata, like a slow movement with Alberti bass in the left hand. Literally, there are like that's just such a great, easy way to show a class when you're starting out in a concept to show them that. You can't argue with that. I mean, maybe you could find an even simpler example with a different composer of a similar thing. But what's your I know theory is not your realm, Dr. Morales, but what's your opinion on all that? It's just honestly, at the end of the day, as us, Albert and I, until we get to a level of understanding and, quite frankly, position. To change how the theory curriculum is taught, there's only so much we can do with the practicality of it.
No, yeah, of course. And actually, I was thinking about this, and I was gonna use Mozart as an example. So I'm very happy y'all are talking about Mozart. And I actually have a question for you now, since you're the music theory guys. Right, so you're saying, okay, yeah, I don't like playing Mozart. I much rather play Mozart than listening to him. It's not also my favorite thing to play, but if I have to choose between listening and playing, I'm playing. I just don't like listening. I think Mozart is cute, but not cute enough to sip my tea while listening to it. But I'm okay playing it anyway. So something I have noticed as a performer, especially in the orchestra repertoire, which is the one I am more in depth, that most orchestras, at least here in the States, I haven't paid too much attention in Mexico, they don't play Mozart, they don't perform Mozart that often anymore. And now you're telling me, oh, we don't want to play Listen Mozart, but we can use it as an example for music theory. And since we are talking about the canon and whether it expands or it reduces, knowing that Mozart is not that performed anymore, would you say maybe Mozart is getting out of the canon as a composer? But still useful as a music theory tool, where like we know Mozart is great, we know his music is good, we're using it to teach, but it's not relatable enough anymore for the overall musician.
I think it depends the Mozart you're talking about because I agree that you maybe might not hear a symphony so often, but also off the top of my head, if I'm playing symphony number 25, 34, 35, 36, 37, 30, and all the way up to 41, that is still, I think, present. Like Prague is still being played. The Jupiter Symphony is still being played. So I get your point
But
that
not as
maybe.
often as other pieces,
No, but
like
I
Beethoven,
think.
like Schumann, like Mendelssohn, like the now modern
So.
music we are listening to in orchestras.
I think the reason for that is there's actually a term in topic theory. Well, it's a topic in general. It's called the Great Symphony itself. I'll put that in quotes. So the first ever Great Symphony, we were talking about Beethoven before. This is a perfect theory thing. Beethoven's Ninth Symphony was considered that Great Symphony. And then the first person to try to replicate that was Schumann did it with his Ninth Symphony. He's dubbed the Great Symphony, also known in Europe as the Seventh Symphony because the numbers are kind of messed up, but it's the Ninth Symphony in the States here. And then from there, Robert Schumann noticed that the sound of the symphony was originally used as a one-time thing. You were supposed to hear it once and never hear it again. Mozart's time was like that. Schubert, up until that Ninth Symphony, was like that. He had the intention of it was going to be played once, and then by the ninth one, where it's great, that one would be played again. The entire thing's in a sonata form. The entire thing's 54 minutes long. We think great as in large, and they kind of thought of it as the same way. This is something that's
can be treasured. And then from there, Schumann, his second symphony is his great symphony, we'll put in quotes, his C major one, because it's cyclic. So now the style has changed. The theme is going to go out throughout the entire thing. Brahms had the 24-year internal debate of, will I ever have a Beethoven symphony? And his first symphony is arguably more Beethoven and great than Beethoven 9, right? Because
He
it's
got bigger.
actually, it got even bigger. And we can, you know, this line can go on forever. So I think it's the I think it has to do with that also, that even Haydn's the same exact way. You know, there's 104 Haydn symphonies, yet
I only
we
know
don't. Yeah, it's like, oh, I know 104, maybe 45
one.
for the farewell. Like, there's a couple nicknamed ones, but there's a reason for that. I think it's because, again, how are you doing your program nowadays too? So nowadays programs are based on themes. So I think the reason why Mozart is being swept out a little bit is because if you're doing a theme, like a pastoral theme, Beethoven's easier because his sixth symphony exists and has a name to it.
So you're saying
But
that the
yeah.
repertoire has to be programmatic, otherwise it doesn't work nowadays?
I'm
Because
not
I
gonna
think
say
you're,
that's
I
how it,
agree. I
I don't think
agree,
it has to
absolutely.
be like that. I think how conductors are thinking is, I've never had a conductor personally where the maestro stands up there and the first thing they say is like, this is the theme of our concert, whether it be women, whether it be so my favorite one I ever played is Music from the North. And that was, you know, we're playing music, we play like Finlandia with Sibelius and then any of the Finnish composers, right? So I'm not saying it has to be programmatic, but one of the first thing a conductor sits down and does is like, what are we gonna do? And again, Beethoven, I think he's just more accepted in the symphonic repertoire. That's like at least once a year we're gonna play a Beethoven cycle. It depends because he's such a giant that I'm sure every 5 to 10 years it's like, okay, we'll play all nine in one concert for all these hours, and then it's like you could close the door and come back in 5 years. That's sure, but I think composers nowadays, and even as teachers, we think about this with lesson planning. Everything has a reason behind it. And how are we going to expand the canon again? Well, having a title for your program is something you'll remember, exactly like I just did. It's, you know, oh, Songs from the North. You kind of know what it's going to be about before you go there. That's what brings you there. And usually it's, you know, you have one piece that's in the canon, one piece that might not be, and then an encore of whatever he likes himself, right? Or she likes themselves. So again, I don't think it needs to be programmatic, but I think 85% of conductors are definitely thinking that way of how am I going to get people into the concert hall? Well, having a piece from the canon and having a theme is definitely the way to do it.
This was a perfect, a beautiful conversation, and good point bringing up Mozart. That's not really a trend that I was super aware of, but that's interesting to think about. And a perfect transition into the other. So we're talking before, we're essentially talking about the top-down reasons of the canon, pedagogy, top-down. Now we're talking bottom-up, which is public reception and expectation. Some of it is still top down because it's like the conductor or who's ever programming is like, you know, here is the music. This is what I will platform. But that's usually in reaction to whatever they think will sell the most tickets, fill the most seats, create the most engagement. Part of that is, of course, you know, Albert, I think you laid it out well. That is typically what happens. There's like a canon piece. Something that is like 1 foot in, 1 foot out of the canon, and then either something really familiar or really out this world. Like those are usually the three types. I actually did have a conductor once. I'm not going to say their name, because I'm not going to say something nice. I did have a conductor once that stuck strictly, like if the theme of the concert, if the piece did not conjoin with that, out of here. For example, the one time I performed Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, we were also playing Hungarian Dance number 5. So the theme of the concert was the number 5. And so my string quartet was going to perform on stage before the orchestra came out. And what we had been working on for like a month was this really, really cool string quartet piece called The Bridal Trilogy by a group called the Danish String Quartet. It was written maybe like 5 or 6 years ago. And it was this really cool mix of like classical style string quartet writing, but with like Nordic fiddle music. It was really cool. And when our conductor came into our rehearsal, she said, "What piece did you all decide for this concert?" We're like, "This one." And and they said, "You know, what else do you have?" And we flipped, "Well, we have this and this," and they were like, "Oh, yes, that." It was the Brandenburg Five. Just that was disappointing. And it was to fit with that stupid theme of everything being number five. so whatever. But okay, so that there's a little anecdote. But we're talking about public expectation reaction. So I think it would be hard to argue against that. The reason why that expectation is built is through decades and decades and decades of top down. This is the significant music, it being good music and it being recepted into people's hearts, into their ears. This is what I expect when I go to a symphony concert. I love this music, and it's a cyclical thing, you know, over time. So then that comes to the question of, is it even possible to fully expand the canon outside of academic and pedagogical standards? Because we can do as much as we want, and I want to personally as a theorist, as an educator, but it's only if the public receives it. So then the question is it feasibly monetarily possible to, through this whole problem of the public needs to accept it, are you able to, in the public, expand the canon? Like, for example, Albert said, you know, Amy Beach is within our canon, maybe for us, but I would actually argue in the grand scheme of things, she's kind of not, if you want to go with the concert going crowd. And so how do you bring it out into the world, expanding the canon, making it more diverse, while still contending for the very real issues of public reception and funding?
Funding's it. I mean, so this is where I think young people's concerts were the brilliant idea that they used to have. But the problem was, also go back and look at what they were playing is part of the problem of trying to expand it. You know, they're playing these pieces that we did call were part of the canon, and Leonard Bernstein gets up there and he says some really fancy things, really big words. And then we move on from there. And it's like, oh, now the people who are still alive going to our concerts, why do they go to the symphony? It might not be because they're musicians. It could be because I remember the way Leonard Bernstein made me feel when I was 6 years old and I went to the concert, which is totally valid. And again, that's part of the issue too. It's like, outside of a college town, say, like in Tallahassee, who's your audience that's coming to it? Is it elderly people like we expect it to be, or is it young students like us here at FSU who are probably filling up most of those seats where we could change it a little bit? I think it also comes down to what music you're exposed to. We talk about this in theory sometimes of Schoenberg always had this idea that atonal music was going to be the next thing and everyone would listen to it. But the reason why it didn't really take off is because my mom wasn't playing me 12-tone Rose when I was sitting in a crate. She was playing me Mozart, right? Because that's what she was told to do off one reading. So it's it comes down to that. It's like, what are we choosing to expose our own kids to? And if you tell someone who's not a classical musician, oh, you want to get your students into classical music, yeah, you should listen to Lulu, the opera, and hear some 12-tone Rose, the person's going to go mentally insane. The child might be okay at the end of the day because they might learn the tools and like the music, but the person who doesn't know atonal music is going to look at you with 12 heads like, really? This is what you recommended for me to play for my own child? It's like this opera about this person going mentally insane, right? So it all really depends. But who's coming is that biggest question. Also, I will argue with you where Amy Beach does lie in our canon. Yes, as violinist, I agree that maybe in our canon she does. Remember, the Gaelic Symphony does exist, and we can totally play her music in the symphonic way, and that is a very well-known piece. So
that's a fair point.
I will give FSU credit, though, because a couple of the musicology alums just released a book on Amy Beach's music that won an award and was popping up a lot. And it's like, I know who Amy Beach is, but like you said, not everyone may not know who Amy Beach is. So go out, go read some Amy Beach, because, and listen, because Amy Beach is great. Anyway, that was just, I had to throw that out there. That was like, ooh, I can think of another thing, not violin.
Fair enough. Fair enough. You got me on that. So good points, Albert. Dr. Morales, how do you feel about that?
I agree, and I also feel it's like I agree with it can be changed. I don't think it should be destroyed. I just don't think it's worth it. If anything, we can just include and eventually welcome new pieces and new composers to the canon. And if that doesn't happen, I don't think that's the end of the world either. We do not need to put something inside the canon for it to be remembered or appreciated. And I also I think it's like a step situation, depending on where you want to go. I feel it starts first with us, the teachers, the pedagogues, whether we want our students to be exposed to this new music, exposed to different genders, different nationalities, different ways of composing and writing and playing, of course, because let's remember the composers wrote what the musicians could do. So that also, if that's a constant evolution we are constantly addressing. So it comes from us whether whether I want my students to learn that or not. Just like what we were saying, if you want to do something or your professor decides not to help you, then that professor is good for something else, while other professors are good for something else. That's the thing. So I tell my students whether I want them or not to learn this or X, whatever type of piece. It also comes from the programming. As I said, I made it my personal goal to add new Mexican music in my recitals. And I have friends who've done the same. You didn't meet Dr. Eva Casado. She's from Spain. She did her master's with me. She also added Spanish music. Dr. Mattia Imponenti added Italian music in his repertoire. Our friend Brett Bechakas, he tried to put Greek music in his repertoire. But we're doing this because it is important for us that we want to share this new music. If we have this individual interest of showing off new music that we like and that we find important for us, that's a way of spreading the word. Hey, this composer exists. Hey, this music exists, and it sounds like this. And it's up to you whether you want to repeat it or not. Same happens with the orchestras. Maybe the orchestras are taking it a little bit more safe by, yes, I'm going to play something that's part of the canon. And I'm also going to introduce this new piece. And I'm going to see how my audience react to this type of music. And then I decide whether I repeat something similar or I expose a different kind of music by a different kind of composer. I like that orchestras are doing that because eventually, one of these days, one of the seasons program is going to be all contemporary music. And you know your audience is going to go. You know they're going to attend it because you have already exposed them to something that they sort of like and they found interesting enough for paying a ticket to just be exposed to all but that, right?
Sure.
Like all of it.
Yeah, good points. Yeah, it is a gradual thing. Even if we wanted to, quote
And
unquote,
it's,
destroy
yeah,
the
but
canon, yeah.
yeah. And we're gonna be exactly destroy, keeping, forgetting, putting aside. It's a personal thing of us musicians. So if you want to keep playing Beethoven, do keep playing Beethoven. I'm gonna be playing something else, and I think that's fine. We are so different. It's okay to like different things as well. And there
Yes.
should be a demand before there's an offer in that way.
There
But
should
we
be
have to make the demand
a Yeah.
happen.
We do. Personally, I don't think the canon is going anywhere. Maybe contextualizing it differently, but there's so much history and importance in education, it's probably not going anywhere. And that's, you know what? That's fine. Just as you said. That's fine. Well, all right. We're a bit into this podcast and we're coming to the end. So we solved the problem, right? Yeah, totally. We talked about everything that we could. No. You can teach 5 graduate courses on the classical canon and the issues in and around it, and you would not fully, quote unquote, solve it. This is a very long going, complex issue with so many facets. I'm sure people who are listening are like, oh, why didn't they go in that direction? Why didn't you go in that direction? You know, there's so many different angles to take this from, and I think this has been great. I've learned from both of you some new perspectives or ways of looking at it that are brand new to myself, and I'm sure the listeners have too, which is great. And so, okay, we're coming down to final. Well, okay, first, before final thoughts, just so people know what's going on with you guys, let's go with Dr. Morales first. What's next for you, Dr. Morales? What's going on? What professional things are going on with you? What's going on?
Well, I'm still in Gainesville, Florida, at least for the next year. I'm playing with Lakeland Symphony Orchestra, the Ocala Symphony Orchestra, and the Gainesville Orchestra. I'm still auditioning to the big orchestras. Hopefully one day of these it will happen. I also teach, I'm teaching music appreciation at the moment, and I'm also a violin instructor at the youth orchestra in Flagler County. And here in Alachua County, I'm also working with two elementaries, part of a oh, what's the mentoring program? There you go. A mentoring program that Gainesville Orchestra has. And I'm just chilling and vibing, considering what I want to do with the rest of my life, which is totally fine. And I need people to understand it's totally fine to not figure it out right away.
Yes, I'm sure you're not
So that's
stressed.
where I am right now.
I'm sure you're not stressed at all.
Oh, not at all.
No. And so your contact info will be in the description of the episode, but what would be the best way for people to contact you if they have any
Maybe,
comments,
honestly,
questions?
Instagram.
Okay.
I'm obsessed with Instagram. It's a bad thing, but it is what it is. So yeah, I forgot my account. I think it's Famina underscore Mitza with C, like in Sue. And yeah, follow me on fun. I always share like what I'm doing, what I'm practicing, crazy ideas that I have. Also personal things that I have, which is fun.
Yes, you
Because
do.
so yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, yes, I'm a great musician, but I'm also a great person, and I have thoughts and opinions, and they
Yes.
all have something to do with music, so there you go.
Perfect, perfect. Your Instagram will be, of course, in the description of this episode. So, Albert, throw it to you. What's going on with you? What's coming up in the future?
Sure. So, of course, there's teaching right now that I have responsibility for. I'm a graduate assistant here at Florida State, and I'm teaching Theory 1 and Oral Skills 3 this semester. So I'm having fun with that. Again, first degree in education. I love teaching more than anything. So hopefully continue to do research on that in the future. But big things that I need to do besides a goal this year would be to present at one of our conferences. That's I just need to put something and force me, even if I get rejected, force myself out there and, get to my first conference. And that's my goal because this is only my first year really doing theory research, first full year finally. So I think it's time, be uncomfortable a little bit and go stab and have some fun. The second part of that is, of course, applying to PhD programs. Although I've been offered some teaching spots back in New York, I do want to. I'm one of those believers where I don't know if I'll ever go back to school, especially because we're this far, if I don't continue now. And I really, really love doing higher education. I really like school in general. So I would love to potentially stay here for a PhD, but I'm applying to a boatload of places and hopefully have a hard decision to make between the various schools. That would be the goal.
That would be the goal indeed. Seems like you have a light load as well. And so what would be the best way to contact you?
Sure. So, I'll definitely put some stuff in the text box later for us to put on the tag. Off the top of my head, definitely email. It's just my last name, first name, 25 at gmail.com. So WheelerAlbert25 at gmail.com. Just because I don't know my Instagram off the top of my head, but I'll definitely link that on there, and that's another great spot to find me.
Sure. And so to close out this podcast, I always like to give the panelists or guests, depending on the type of episode, the last word for any thoughts you want to include. So let's go with Dr. Morales. What if, anything else you want to say about this topic or just music in general to the audience, what would that be?
Be curious, find the canon, embrace it, know it, and then expand from it, and you'll find something you will like, and eventually you'll find new music and new composers. And that's just the way to learn music. Also, don't be scared of saying something doesn't make you feel right. Like, if you don't like one composer, feel free to say that composer doesn't make you feel right. And that is totally fine. I think there's a lot of toxicity amongst ourselves. It's like, how can you not like Mozart? For example, when I openly say, oh, I don't enjoy listening to Mozart, a lot of people is like, what is wrong with you? There's nothing wrong with me. I just don't like it. But I love Rachmaninoff. And that's, no one has told me, how can you like Rachmaninoff? Or when I tell people, oh, how can, like, oh, I like John Adams. How can you like John Adams? I just do. I just do. I like John Adams. I don't like Mozart. And once you find out it's okay to say it out loud and it's okay to not like something, you're going to find a lot new music that you're going to make, that you're going to feel more comfortable with. At the end of the day, these are emotions we're talking about. Play and explore what you like, not what we are telling you to like.
That's a very good point. Thank you for that. And Albert, same thing to you. Anything about this conversation, music in general, to the audience, what would you say?
Sure. So I would definitely go on the part of listening and not just listening to classical music, listen to all genres of music. We took a popular music class together, and I'm not saying I've never listened to popular music before, but it was much harder to do that class not listening as much popular music. And finally, now I exposed myself to more and I enjoyed it more than I thought I would enjoy it, might I add. So definitely, just go out and listen. And it's, again, it's okay to have opinions about pieces, and you'll go back to what you want to listen to. And that's part of the process. So that's one thing from Queens taught me for sure. We didn't get to talk about it too much, but I had a listening list when I was there. I had to pass 4 listening exams of, you know, 160 pieces. You know, you just go for like 40 per one over various periods. And what I learned from that is not always that I enjoyed all the music, but I enjoyed the process of just obtaining knowledge and wanting to be good at it and just loving knowing what's out there. So just go listen, have fun with listening. You'll know what you'll like. And that's totally okay if you don't like something. You'll eventually go into your cocoon. Like, I know Aaron loves Pitbull, and I've given Pitbull so much more of a try now because Aaron loves his Pitbull, and that's totally okay because now I'm starting to enjoy his motivation just as much, right? So it's
what a great way to end that. Oh man, yes. Thank you, Albert, for that last little bit. That's great. All right, so this, thank you both, Dr. Morales and Albert Wheeler. You know, the second Theorist Composer Collaboration Roundtable on the classical canon. This has been a fantastic conversation. Thank you both for coming on to here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Aaron again. I want to thank you for listening to this episode of the Theorist Composer Collaboration. I also want to give another big thank you to Dr. Pamela Mireles and Albert Wheeler for coming on to discuss the classical canon. Both of their contact infos are listed in the description of this episode, and I would appreciate it if you could show them some support. You know, it has been a while since the recording of this outro and the recording of the actual roundtable. And I have to say, looking back, it was a fantastic conversation. Both Dr. Morales and Albert brought a whole bunch of different perspectives that I have not necessarily heard before, and it was a really great time. For example, you know, Dr. Morales's perspective as a college-level educator in pedagogy, something that I'm not very familiar with at all. And I really, really loved Albert's comparison of the classical music canon to the canon of literature, a term that's also very often used in that field. So those are just two small little snippets of a long and complicated conversation, but I really appreciated their perspectives. And I want to again give an incredibly special thank you to both Dr. Pamela Mireles and Albert Wheeler for joining this podcast and this roundtable for the discussion on the classical canon. For further updates and notifications on the Theorist Composer Collaboration, make sure to follow our Instagram and Facebook pages. You can listen to future episodes through our host website, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, and YouTube, so make sure you subscribe to the platform of your choosing. If you want to monetarily support the work of the TCC, you could click the link to our Buy Me a Coffee page. All donations are highly appreciated. All of the relevant links to follow, listen to, and support the show are in the description. TCC episodes are posted every other week on Mondays, and don't miss our blog posts, which go live a few days before a new episode is added. I'm also excited to promote that our next episode of the Theorist-Composer Collaboration will be with Dr. Francisco Aviar de Alba and his piece Uncharted. There will be more information on this in the upcoming blog posts and, of course, in the next full episode. Make sure to follow our social media accounts and relevant streaming platforms because you won't want to miss it. But until then, this is Aaron, and thank you for joining the TCC.